know, you're waiting for certain data sets to arrive and they don't, or there's a firmware update. Suddenly you have to change the way that you've written certain pieces of code and refactor things. Those are real realities of planning a project. And the best way I can say in order to get good timelines is actually engaging in a process that you can trust.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Xceto Playback Podcast, the podcast bringing you the latest industry news, trends, and tech advancements in the OTT and video industry. My name is Stanley Auger, and as always, I'm joined alongside my co-host, Neil Van Zyl, and today we'll be speaking to Xceto's VP of Operations, Michael Chan, here in North America, and we'll be talking about what is needed to deliver a successful OTT project. Mike, how about starting off with introducing yourself?
Yeah, thanks for introducing me. It's great to be on the pod. As they say, I've been part of Xceto for about 10 years now, and really had the fortunate chance to do quite a few different things. I joined first as a project manager and have been able to kind of wear many different hats. I get involved a bit with program management, work my way into a few engineering kind of focus roles, and then ultimately ending up where I am today, overseeing a lot of the project deliveries and some of the operations of the business. So it's great to cross that 10-year mark with the business. But you know, I think more than that, it's felt not at all like 10 years. So it's been very quick and it's been very fun.
Well, it's great to have you with us, Mike. And outside formalities too, what I can say from my end about Mike is that he's just a super awesome guy and somebody that I look up to a lot. And we talk a lot about running too, so we're going to be doing a little bit of that in this podcast.
Great, sounds fun.
Great. Well, why don't I kick things off with some questions here, and we'll get going. So, for my first question, Mike, what do content providers need to consider to ensure the completion of a best-in-class OTT service?
That's a great question. I think we've done a lot of these projects for many different customers and clients over the years. And I think the thing that we need to remember is that every content provider or media company, broadcaster, operator, they all have their own strategic, I think, outlook in terms of how they add value to the end consumers, whether it's in the actual experience they're providing or the type of content. I think they all have their own focus, right? So I think one of the most important things to consider, of course, is what you're trying to do when you're building that OTT service. But what I do find is a little bit tough is, of course, focusing on that question and really answering it for yourselves, because a lot of the times, a lot of people are just trying to play catch up. They want to bring their catalog to the OTT, you know, VOD or streaming service world, and they look at products like Netflix, or they look at products like Disney, and they try to compare themselves and try to copy their features. And I think while that's a great way to think about what you need to bring as a minimal viable product, sometimes get, you know, the reason of why or what we're trying to achieve gets lost, right, in the actual deployment of these projects. You know, what is the experience we're trying to provide? Who's the end audience? And what is actually the value proposition that they're trying to bring to their viewers? And you know, does it come out in their content or the way that the content's being serviced, or is it coming out in a bit of that visual element? And so, you know, we have to answer those questions first. And once you have a clear vision of what you want to do with the streaming experience, then I think that sets you up for success. You know, I think there's a lot of things that you can then prioritize accordingly, and you know, timelines and product requirements, those are all very complex. You can go through many months of planning, but when you really get down to it, understanding what your end product and your end vision is for your own OTT service is super important.
It makes sense that, of course, it depends on the vertical and the user base that you're trying to hit completely. Going a little bit more into depth there, how much of the project scope needs to be in order before the project begins? So like what needs to be done in a discovery phase to ensure that the project is successful?
Yeah, so I think building on top of the answer I just provided, right? So, you know, for example, if you're into sports, right? And the whole experience revolves around the live viewing experience. Then I think understanding how that component comes together is super important. If you are about getting premium movies and, you know, allowing the movies to be aired kind of in this exclusive premium kind of TVOD or SVOD type of experience, then understanding how to actually create that transaction through your OTT service, and then bringing that experience to whether it's a mobile phone or 10-foot viewing experience becomes your focus. And whatever it is, I think that's all you need, right? Understanding what the core use case is for your end consumer or viewer. And once you understand the end goal and you can visualize it, that's the scope that needs to be really defined very well before beginning the project. So for example, if you know it's all about watching MMA, right, and you need to be able to have a premium TVOD experience, then understanding the scope in terms of how the transaction is going to happen and what the user experience is going to be like when you actually hit enter button to pay for the live experience, whether it's before the event happens or while it's during the event. I think those use cases, if you define them very well, then you're able to go down a solutions engineering path and build a couple of technical pieces to ensure that you can actually create that flow end to end. And I think that's at the crux of it, what you need to start any OTT project or any project specifically, to then understand where your risks are, where your bottlenecks will be, and what are the dependencies that you're looking at before you get the project started.
Just a question about that, Mike. I'm sure you've worked on, you know, a number of projects before. Have you seen something that's sort of a like term across different clients in terms of elevating that experience? Because for somebody like me, you know, a content provider, I've got my content and I just want to bring that to somebody, right? Have you seen something similar where that experience is elevated, or how would you almost have that conversation of elevating that with a content provider?
No, I don't think I've seen specifically any one theme kind of come up as you know, must have in order to elevate your OTT experience from a feature set perspective anyways. But you know, I've definitely heard other things that are more common and more, I think, a common denominator, if I can use that language, amongst OTT services that really do have an excellent end user experience. And it's things like, I need it to be snappy. I need it to be performant. I need it to be fast. And so there are elements of getting your application to be super high quality that will actually give that end user experience that extra polish that they're looking for. And you know, very early days, it's about figuring out how to get rid of things like buffering, right? When we started to do projects in 2013, the internet, you know, the bandwidth and the speed in which we can load videos created a lot of buffering. And so a lot of our work revolved around how do we create an experience that makes the buffering less painful, right? And whether that was through adaptive bitrate streaming that became popular later, or through a couple of, I think, UI treatments that allows us to, you know, have a spinner or some type of loading that doesn't feel like it's a product of, you know, getting stuck or waiting for something to load and having it load in the background and then display, you know, very polished or in a kind of UX designed way, which feels premium. That elevated the experience for sure. And so I don't think there was like one feature set that really did it for me over the years. But one of the common threads is, you know, has to work. It has to work fast. It has to be performant. And you know, I think that's where we put a lot of our focus near the end of our projects, is to make sure that everything comes together nicely. That we're not just delivering features and then forgetting that there are real users at the end trying to get through the application. And what do they actually experience, right, when they kick back after a long day and they just load up their OTT service, and how would they feel? And I think if we can put ourselves in their shoes and make it really performant and you know, look really nice at the same time, then we've done our jobs.
Yeah. I guess the OTT has probably come a long way from our expectations, or sort of where things were in our expectations now, right? Like you speak about the buffering. I don't think I've come across buffering in many years, right? But it's, I guess, those types of things that now we just live with, and we just sort of assume. But they're the recurring sort of common denominators that you speak about. Interesting.
I think actually, I'm not sure how common this is across the board, but one thing that does come to mind a little bit is casting. I think, you know, if I rewind, casting, being able to send something from your phone or your mobile device onto a 10-foot screen was pretty game changer. And now I do think that is expected out of the box, but you know, maybe it's something that I take for granted as a basic feature set, right? Because it's actually something that when we first did it, it was extremely challenging. I think in the early days to actually, you know, create a sender and receiver and to be able to actually get that casting functionality going, it was the first of its kind. And we ran into many challenges doing it. But I kind of forget how amazing that feature is. And of course, I use that every day. And I'm sure that when we look at the statistics, a lot of people are looking for this feature.
So talking about a little bit more there, where you're saying it's not just the features we're developing, right? It's the performance optimizations, it's the innovations. And these things take a little bit extra time. How do you go about setting realistic timelines with a customer that enable the team to deliver this quality project, but still allows the customer to achieve their goals?
I think timing is it's tricky. I think from a planning perspective, you'd love to be able to achieve every single timeline that you set out. And that's just not the reality of things. I think the reality of projects is it's pretty messy. You know, we certainly go through a scoping exercise. We do some high-level estimations on how long things will take. And these estimations are rooted in previous experiences. So when we deliver a project, we get a good sense of how long things should take. But timing is messy because there are real challenges that pop up in the middle of a project. For example, you know, you're waiting for certain data sets to arrive and they don't. Or there's a firmware update, and suddenly you have to change the way that you've written certain pieces of code and refactor things. Those are real realities of planning a project. And the best way I can say in order to get good timelines is actually engaging in a process that you can trust, right? And then working through the process in which you can prioritize whether it's the feature that comes first or the timeline that comes first or the complexity of certain combinations of the two, right? Or more of a hybrid approach. And when I allude to kind of the process here, you know, the popular software development frameworks or methodologies these days, of course, is Agile, right? And Agile in its tenant is, of course, delivering things iteratively, delivering them fast, and then delivering it so that you can review what's worked and what hasn't worked. You know, when I talk about Agile, the thing that really you know, makes it or break it for some companies is actually the mindset, how they think about the process. Some people think about it as a set of activities that you do, and some people actually embrace it as a change in how they actually operate. And Agile fundamentally is extremely hard to implement. You know, it's not a wishy-washy framework in which we only look 2 weeks ahead and forget about this, you know, 6-month planning process that used to happen in Waterfall. Agile is this commitment to continuous conversations, having continuous planning, and the real discipline to document along the way, a real discipline to dive into the details of every user story or feature set that you're discussing, and then go through the test case planning and the revision of all the details that come up week to week. And if you do it properly, the process will get you there, right? And, you know, I think there's a focus on timelines, like you asked, Neil. But, you know, the focus for me is if you do the process correctly and you do it with real discipline and you grind it out week after week, you will get to the results probably faster than you would expect. But what I do find that is a flaw in some of the projects that we have experienced and that I've seen over the years is that once you relax on some of the disciplines, then things start to slip. And it can be a slippery snowball, right? You can actually miss 1 week, 2 weeks, and then 3 weeks, and then all of a sudden you're playing catch up. And then the timelines feel they're getting away from you. But to bring it back to kind of the question, Neil, I heard this great quote. And this quote recently really helped me frame, you know, how we need to focus on doing the work, right? And the quote goes like this: the magic that we're looking for is in the work that we're avoiding. And a lot of the teams want the magic of this perfect timeline, you know, to be able to achieve and reach these end goals on time or ahead of schedule. But they avoid some of the hard work, and the hard work, it isn't the fun stuff. You know, you gotta stay behind, you gotta talk about the nitty-gritty details, and sometimes you just want to gloss over the details because it's easy to say, oh yeah, we'll just talk about that when we need to talk about it. Or, you know, we put off planning test cases because we, you know, you say, you know, we can't see it yet, we don't have enough visuals to start planning the acceptance criteria. Or we might even be tempted in saying, well, you know, such and such isn't providing me with what I need today, but I don't want to engage in the hard work of giving them feedback or telling them that they gotta do a little bit better. And that's the hard work. I think that's the hard work that a real agile mindset promotes. And you gotta be really disciplined and engage in that work and grind it out if you want to get to good timelines. So I don't think inherently there's any magic in getting good timelines other than putting in the hard work and trusting the process. And, you know, from a delivery perspective, I think it's trusting the process, right? We can all put great plans on paper. There's a lot of good project managers out there. I've talked to a lot of good planning organizations, and everyone has the foundations, right? Everyone knows how to put a project plan in place. They know how to get the milestones out there, but it's in doing the work. That's how you get to the timelines. And, you know, hopefully, Neil, that answers a bit of your question, but, you know, I think grinding it out, doing the hard work week after week is what gets you to the end goal.
Yeah, and I was going to just comment on that too. I guess if you break it down into small chunks, like most things in life as well, it's a little bit less overwhelming too, right? Just so I understand correctly as well, Mike, is a agile mindset something that Axedo adopted for themselves, or is this just works well within sort of the OTT industry? And then what is, you know, the compare contrast versus a waterfall methodology, for example?
Yeah, I think universally, most software organizations or people that develop code have adopted the agile methodology and the frameworks. And there's over 40 methodologies out there, right? And so there's ways that you know, you can have Scrum or Safe work for you. But I think more than anything, when we talk about the agile mindset, it's about, you know, prioritizing people and the teams that are in the work that we do over a process. And while process is important, you know, the people that are actually doing the work have deep insight into how to do the work. And so prioritizing the people over the process, it's prioritizing, you know, working software over comprehensive documentation. But if you're doing it right, you're getting comprehensive documentation as you go, right? It's about getting customer collaboration over contract negotiation. And the last thing, which is probably one of my favorites, is responding to change over following a static plan. And agile basically says, you know, let's think about the stuff on the left, right? The former part of the statements rather than the latter ones on the right. While both are important, when you have to prioritize something, you know, prioritize people over process, get to working software over complete or comprehensive documentation, get yourself closer to your customers or closer to your partners and collaborate over, you know, and change requests and contract negotiations out there. And then finally, you know, you got to respond, right? You got to respond to the change as opposed to just sitting there and saying, well, you know, according to the plan, we didn't do this, now on to the next thing. And that is kind of at the crux of it. If you can adopt more of that mindset shift closer to the former statements, you will get a lot more success on projects.
You talked about how important collaboration is, and in a vendor situation like Exceedo, where we're often working with multiple partners across different video workflows, how is that collaboration managed? I guess, how can you work with all these different partners to ensure that you're still meeting the end goals of the app?
You know, it's a really good question. And we worked with a lot of different partners over the years. And one of the things that we need to, you know, get into a rhythm is actually figuring out how often we come together. It's really easy to kind of get to kick off, you know, meet all of your partners, you meet your kind of working team, your you know, counterparts, maybe the partners or the integration points that you know, are supposed to come into the project. And then we distribute the work and then we forget about each other. And it's pretty common to do that. And so I think in order for us to establish better collaboration, it's just finding ways to come together more often. And I think the COVID and the pandemic has created a much stronger remote work. And in some ways, I think that's benefited us. You know, we've been able to get better tools, right? Whether it's through collaboration tools like Jamboard and retrospectives, I think those have all improved with the hybrid work models. We've also, you know, I think received a much higher quality of online work over the years. But one thing that's actually decreased, right, with the pandemic is in-person work. And as much as possible, whenever we can, we invite our teams, our customers, and our partners to work together under one roof. And I think that's really important as well. We can't forget about, I think, the actual power of meeting face-to-face and working through some of the more complex problems. Because when you're together, you get a really, you know, I think, solid chance to iron out problems that, you know, sometimes you don't get to get into the weeds when you do online work. And, you know, for context, you know, we've had a couple of our partners come into our offices, even as recently as last month, and, you know, sat together with us for a week and just worked through some of the more challenging technology problems that come up. And whether that's, you know, changing firmware or nuances in how we work with small technical pieces when we're integrating things together, that in person allows us to kind of work much, much better.
And in addition to, you know, working sort of, or I guess, learning how to work in this new type of environment, are there any other common challenges that you've seen in delivering OTT projects just in general? And do you have any suggested solutions on these challenges?
Maybe I'll answer your question in a slightly different way. I think there's so many challenges that's hard for me to pull one common thread, right? Sure. When we work on a lot of projects, in the context that we do it here at Exceedo anyways, which is that we are market leaders, we often embark on pretty challenging and ambitious projects, and in a way, in terms of trying new things with our technology and with the OTT industry at large, we're trying new things that people haven't done before. Inherently, we expect challenges to be on every project, whether that's compatibility issues, whether that's something that we're doing for the first time and it's not quite supported yet, you know, by a different OEM, whatever that may be, I think the challenges will always be there. But what's something that can help us get over those challenges? And for me, it's actually this idea of embracing failure, right? And actually at Exceedo, we have a core value of being courageous. And one of our core values is to be courageous. And to be courageous means that you have to look at failure or the potential of failure and embark on that journey anyways. And one of the things is when you embrace failure or normalize failure, you can often then change the way you think about a problem, right? And so if you don't embrace failure, you're kind of operating out of this fear of being able to achieve something. And when you look at a challenge and all you're doing is thinking about how I can avoid failure, you're always thinking about mitigation plans. You're always thinking about lengthening timelines. You're always thinking about what are the different ways I can detour around this challenge? But the thing that is really neat about embracing failure is then you start to wipe away some of the thinking here, or some of these mindset that prevent you from actually looking at the challenge holistically, creatively, and then finding a solution through it. And because when you're not afraid of failing and you're just, you know, I think focused on solving a problem and picking yourself up and trying again, if you can't get through the problem the first time, then you really can do the hard work of, and sometimes the hard work is the creative work, right? And the creativity doesn't come out unless you have accepted failure as a possibility. And so when you've accepted that failure is a possibility and you still exercise the courage to go through it, then you can overcome these challenges much easier. So when I look at it, you know, I think, you know, there's no quote unquote common challenge other than the challenge exists in all projects, right? I think that is the common thread that I would say. And as long as you can expect that there are these challenging moments in every project, that's when you can then embrace the failure, go through them, and then come out the other side faster. I think that's actually one of the best ways to kind of get over a challenge, is to go right into it. I think if you start to plan your ways around it, then the challenge typically creeps back up, right? You know, you make a little sidestep detour around a technical challenge, only to find that that challenge is still there at the end of the project waiting for you, right? And so sometimes, you know, you think you've managed the risk by doing some smart maneuvering around how you're going to overcome that challenge, only to find that it's still there. And, you know, I think my advice for anyone embarking on anything ambitious is to just realize that there will be a challenge and that failure will be part of the process. And as soon as you can embrace it, you'll come through it much faster.
Let's go a little bit past just the general product lifecycle. Let's go to post to app launch. Obviously, managing and expanding a service is every bit as important as the initial release. Based on your experience, how should publishers conduct the post-launch planning or the management of and evolution of their service?
Yeah, I think it comes back down to what I mentioned earlier, having a vision for your OTT service. I think when you have a vision for what you're trying to achieve or where you're trying to go, naturally, you'll probably have a product backlog filled with, you know, features that you want to implement but couldn't squeeze it into the original timelines, right? So I think one of the things is, if you've done the visioning correctly, there's probably a plethora of things that you want to put out there. Part of the post-launch planning process is prioritizing which one's the most important to you. But I think on a more practical note, you know, if you've done the visioning, if you've done the kind of hard thinking about what your value proposition is to the market, then it's about measuring. Right? I think a lot of people fail to measure routinely and then feed back, you know, the numbers back to themselves to see if it's actually working for their strategy, or is it achieving the goals that they've set up to achieve. And so, yeah, I think measuring is a good one. We've seen a lot of analytics implementations over the years where it's a bit of a, let's track everything and then we'll figure out what to do with everything after the fact. But where I've seen kind of the best use of the analytics is usually when they have a focus on what they want to achieve, and they've tailored the analytics to kind of really measure if they're getting the right type of engagement, or if they're getting the right type of outcomes for certain content types, or, you know, certain content strategy, and to actually have an analytics focus before you go to market really will help you in the post planning, or so the post production planning part of the project.
A big part of Exceedo's development process is a post development code freeze, where we're working on QA fixes and QA testing. How important is that to the final launch of a project? And going a little bit of a step further, what we've started to try and promote is the importance of QA automation. Are you seeing customers more receptive to the option of QA automation post-launch, or just in general?
I think quality is super important. I think whether they say it out loud or they don't, everyone's looking for it. And so, you know, earlier in the podcast, I mentioned that, you know, how snappy something feels or how polished it looks when there's animations and transitions, like that's super important. So having a period in where quality becomes the primary focus right before launch, of course, is definitely something that every project should do. But you know, speaking on the topic of QA automation, you know, I think the post-launch management of projects can get very expensive without it, right? And so as you grow the feature set, as you grow the different things that you're trying to bring into your OTT streaming service, there's more things to test, right? And so every time you add something, if you were to do it manually, that cost adds up both in time and in dollars, right? So if you added 10 extra features, then you'd have to run a full regression test on all the features you've deployed before and these 10 new features. And it's not a given that, of course, whatever worked before is going to work now, especially if the new features are going to be quite core to the experience. So we have to test everything. And that's where QA automation really comes in. QA automation allows us to, of course, standardize things that should remain quite stable, right? Whether it's an app launch or, you know, launching of the video player, you're checking for audio or monitoring the quality of a video service. Those are things that we can automate through QA. And we have different tools to do that. We have, of course, monitoring tools that can help monitor stream quality, monitor downtime of the stream. But we also have automation tools that allow us to, of course, automate and check UI and backend related components. And I think it's becoming more popular. It's one of those things where it's long-term versus short-term, right? I think people with a long-term perspective of how they're going to be spending their dollars and cents will prioritize getting automation up front, because it is costly, right? To bring in automation means that you're providing an upfront investment into how you want to code and how much of that you want to bring into the code as well, versus, you know, you don't have time, maybe you don't have the budget, then automation might not be a primary focus for you when you get the results of actually going to market faster. And automation might take slightly longer as an upfront investment, but it certainly pays dividend down the line. And it's becoming more popular. We've had a couple of customers really embark on the journey with us to bring QA automation front and center into their applications. And I think they're generally speaking, really getting the reward and the benefits out of it now. Not maybe on the first deployment, not the second post-launch deployment, but you know, the more you deploy, the more you're going to get value out of the automation, especially, you know, being able to focus on maybe a set of manual tests on just the new features, knowing that the automation has taken care of all the other tests that you want to run.
Is the conversation, Mike, that you have with customers or clients that we currently have, are those different than, or how do they differ from maybe a new potential client? Because we see sort of video OTT services as this ongoing active thing, right? There's a lot of coverage that's happening right now. So what does that conversation look like? And how do you, I guess, still, how does that relationship look? And how do those conversations continue to evolve, even if you're sort of at a point of you still have a product that's in market?
I think it's interesting, right? They're very two different conversations. If you have an existing product in market, you know, let's say you have a set-top box experience and you want to bring it into a streaming environment, there's certainly a lot of considerations on keeping and maintaining your existing user interface and the experience that you have there and trying to bring that into an OTT or a digital experience. And that's a very different conversation than saying, you know, we're coming brand new to the market. We don't have a pre-established, you know, user base, and we can really think, you know, blue ocean about some of the ideas that we want to bring into the application. So those are two different, completely different conversations, and they're fun ones, right? I think the one where you're working with an existing streaming provider or an existing broadcaster or media company, and you're trying to bring that into a streaming world, you get to the fun problems of solving how do you keep the core of their identity together while trying to bolt on some innovation, right? And that exploration is very fun, but it's very different than, you know, stepping into a blank canvas and saying, well, you know, look at what we can do with, you know, voice, and look at what we can do with maybe AR and VR, right? And so I think the opportunities to innovate and to explore new ideas are there for brand new OTT service entrants, if I can call them that. And we get a chance to, of course, really workshop in a broad way. And not that you can't with the other companies as well, But of course, they need to keep in mind the existing user base and what they will think is too innovative, right? And in some ways, they need to keep it somewhat similar and familiar so that there's no big disconnect or jarring experience when they transition from one to the next.
Speaking of innovation, let's talk a little bit of trends. What are you seeing occurring in the, I guess, in the OTT ecosystem right now, or what's coming up next?
And I think we've talked a lot about FAST, whether it's kind of in industry news or even in the podcast. I think I've listened to a couple of the past ones, and FAST has come up. So maybe I won't go too much into that, but we're seeing, of course, people are playing with the way that they monetize, right, and playing with the way that they offer access to their content catalog. And so if they were traditionally paywalled behind a subscription VOD service, how do you actually make that content available? So I think as a trend, we're seeing, if it's not through FAST, I think, how do we actually take the catalog and open it up to more people, right? And I think in the past, to have multiple tiers wasn't as common, but now, you know, certainly I can see that we're experimenting and toying around with how do we actually tier out our service so that we can give access to more people. So certainly I think that's something that we're seeing as a trend. I'm also seeing, of course, trends towards smaller and shorter content type. Or how do we actually create engagement with things that are 30 seconds to 2 minutes long? And I think that's definitely different than what we were seeing in the past. And in the past, you know, you would be looking at 20 to 30 minute type of video content, and then the 1 hour and 2 hour or the movie, you know, type length of content. But today, you know, we've definitely worked on a couple of projects within the last couple of years where there is a lot of short form content. How do you create an experience where they can continually flip through that and consume it rapidly while still staying on the same type of content stream, if I can use that terminology, right? If you're looking at action, right, and there's a recommendation engine in the back, how do we continue to cycle through short form content and keep it on genre along the same type of experience, reviewing experience for customers? So yeah, I think that there is a lot of experimentation happening around that.
Great, thanks, Mike. And what would you say to a streaming product owner specifically who is currently considering the option of developing in-house versus going with an agency like Exceedo?
I think the most important thing when selecting Exceedo, if I can use Exceedo, is making sure that you have a partnership mindset.
Right.
I think if we're just strictly talking about, you know, insourcing and outsourcing, then it comes down to dollars and cents, right? Who can do the work for the cheapest amount of money, right? And that's, there's a value to that, right? Like we're in a cost conscious kind of time right now. And so I'm sure that that's top of mind for most budget owners. How do you, you know, get the most with your dollars, and how do you deliver value to your end customer and to your own organization? But I think one of the things that I certainly value a lot is a partnership with our customers. And when I talk about partnership, right, do we have the same ethos? Do we have the same type of mindset when we think about quality? And do we understand what you're trying to achieve? And if we do, then I think that partnership allows you to embark on a journey that's a little bit deeper than just outsourcing, right? And when I think partnership, I mean, we care, we want to care about our customers' work as much as they care, right? And when, you know, some people say the word outsourcing, there's a natural stigma that comes with, well, yeah, they don't care about my work. They're just, you know, hands for hire. They're doing things, and I don't know if they're going to do it with as much care and respect as if we were going to do it ourselves, right? And so let's insource it or build our own in-house team to go do it. But that's expensive, right? And to build your own teams, there's cost around doing that. There's, of course, the hidden cost around doing that as well, which is sometimes not talked about. But when you partner with someone like Exceedo, hopefully we have the same mindset, right? We love TV, we love the streaming industry, and we've done this long enough to make sure that the user experience is something that the end user will love as well. And so when you work with a partner like us, that's been in this industry for a long time, hopefully you're getting the commitment to the same type of mindset, right? And that the work that you give Ixedo, it will be handled with care and handled with love, and that we will be delivered in the same way that you would deliver it yourself. And so, you know, I think that's what I would add to that point about kind of building your own in-house team versus going with kind of someone outsourced versus going with someone at Ixedo. But the most important thing, of course, is partnership mindset, right? To be able to call the people that you select partners. So whether it's Ixedo or not, you know, just making sure that you find a partner that shares the same philosophy and mindset.
Okay, I just want to talk a little bit about you specifically, Mike. This might be a loaded question, give you a little bit of a primer earlier, but to really get to the heart of it, can you describe your leadership philosophy?
That's a loaded question for sure. Because leadership is a big topic. And there's so many things that go into leading successful teams. But one of the things that, you know, is near and dear to my heart is to have more of a servant leadership, to be able to work with your teams, alongside your teams, and really have this mindset that there's nothing that's beneath you, right? You wouldn't do something that, or you wouldn't ask your teams to do something that you wouldn't do yourself, right? And so I think that creates a deep sense of camaraderie, and you get to really get into the trenches, so to speak, together when the tough times come, and they will come. But you know, I think more than that, you know, when you embrace kind of this type of leadership mindset, then you get to build real accountability, right? You get to build real ownership for the things that you assign to one another, and you have a real connection personally, because you employ a lot of empathy when you work with people at this type of level, and you get to know what gets them going and what doesn't. And so I think that's how I would describe, you know, something that I think a lot about when working with teams. And I think that kind of carries forward in, you know, the other aspects of leadership, which is like, you know, communication, collaboration, influence, all that stuff. But at the crux of it, I would describe it more of a servant leadership mindset.
And to contextualize, it wasn't just a random question. I know it's something that Mike even talks to me about, and I can say that working closely with him, I definitely recognize that, Mike, and that leadership that you do have that's influenced on a lot of people such as myself. So I have to just give you kudos and just call it out. And then speaking of contextualized questions, I think Neil also has a final targeted question for you, and maybe I'll leave this one for him.
Sure. I don't really have much to speak on for either of these, but I just got a little question for you. In your experience, what's harder, delivering a premium OTT application or running a half marathon?
That's a great question. I think for me, because I'm not a runner, running a half marathon was quite hard.
So maybe we'll also set the tone here. Mike recently had participated as well in the Toronto half marathon with myself. So I did the full, but Mike did the half. We actually had a number of people from Ixedo. How many was there? There was about seven
of us. Yeah.
Yeah. It's incredible. And then we actually already have more people who are joining in 2024. I wanted to point that out just not to, so that Mike didn't have to say it for himself, but I'll throw the question back at you.
No, it was incredibly difficult for someone that doesn't run. And I think the last time I ran was like 10 years ago. And so what's harder, you know, I think the current flavor of things, running was a little bit harder for me. But what I did recognize is that the mindset's the same, right? Whether you're building a premium OTT application or running a half marathon, I mentioned earlier, you got to grind through it. You know, to do anything at a high level of excellence requires you to put in the hard miles, so to speak, or kilometers, because we're in metric, right? But you got to really put in the hard work. And I wouldn't say that running the half marathon was any harder than doing the hard work of building a premium OTT application. When you're in the thick of things and we're trying to solve really hard problems, it's really hard. You got to put in those long, long hours just to get over one hurdle. And so for me, currently, it was harder running. But, you know, I look back to some of the early days, and even now, you know, when you're kind of going through some of the project deliveries, it can get quite hard and quite challenging, but you got to trust the process. And, you know, for me, it was super rewarding to be able to kind of go and repeat the training over and over and over again, and you know, eventually see it pay off in the end. And so, yeah, you know, that's my answer, but I think next year, maybe it'll be a bit challenging to do the full if I decide to run the full.
Well, Mike has already signed up. So I think a little bit of accountability here is if we say it on the podcast, expect Mike to finish, I think it's October the 21st, the full marathon next year. And going back to the leadership thing as well, you know, he's got a lot of other people on board, which I also admire greatly.
Yeah, well, I think it's one of those things, right? You know, going back to challenges and failures, if you want to grow in anything, and if you want to really take the next step anywhere, you got to embark on things that you don't know if you're going to succeed on. And if you know, like with an 80% chance you're going to get there, you're probably not pushing yourself enough. And actually, one of the things that I value a lot here at Exceedo is we push the envelope quite a bit. Sometimes we take on challenges, pretty unique challenges in the marketplace, things that have never been done before. And, you know, our teams ask us, like, why did we sign up for this? It's like really hard stuff. And, you know, my response is always, well, you know, one, it's fun. It's fun to engage in a challenge that no one's ever done before. And that's part of, you know, why we have fun. But the second is, if you're not doing the hard stuff, then we're not growing. We're not growing as an organization. We're not helping to lead change in the industry. And certainly, you know, I think we would stagnate and, you know, just be like another company trying to deliver software if we never went out and saw some of the hard stuff. So, you know, not just on OTT projects, I guess you're holding me accountable now to run a new distance. So I appreciate that.
Okay, well, that wraps it up, all the questions that we have for today. Mike, it was great to have you on the podcast today. Thank you so much for joining us in person. Greatly appreciated. Before we close off today, is there any last second items that we should ask you or anything that you would like to say to our audience?
No, the pleasure was all mine. It was great. Great to chat with you about some delivery. And, you know, there's always new and exciting challenges to be done. And so we're looking forward to getting as many services out there as possible in the next couple of months. And hopefully you'll hear some news about what we're launching. We're working on some pretty exciting stuff.
Fantastic. Thanks again, Mike. Hopefully you can join us again in a future podcast episode. We'll cut it there. And thanks again for joining today.
Before we cut out here, I just wanted to let our listeners know that I'm looking forward to joining our North American Exceedo team at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas to kick off the new year. If you're attending, reach out to us on LinkedIn or click on the link in the episode description to book a meeting with us. We'd love to host you to discuss all things OTT and showcase our newest solutions and partnerships.
To our guests, thank you for joining Neil and myself on today's episode. And of course, a big thank you to you, our listeners. As a reminder, you can subscribe to the Playback Podcast, which can be found on all major streaming platforms. Or if you'd like to reach out to us directly, send us an email to playback.podcast@exceedo.tv. Have a great day.